Wisconsin Stories is a partnership of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin and Wisconsin Public Television.
Somebody's phone is ringing.
Hello? Yeah. Hi, Nella. I'm out on Lake Michigan. We're right over the wreck of the Niagara. Yeah, what can I do for you?
Major funding for Wisconsin Stories is provided by the Mead Witter Foundation, Incorporated, Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Additional funding is provided by the Halbert and Alice Kadish Foundation, Philip J. and Elizabeth B. Hendrickson, and an advised fund of the Community Foundation of Southern Wisconsin.
Have you ever wondered why there's a sailor on the Wisconsin state flag? Hi, everybody. I'm Debbie Kometz.
And I'm Tracy Will. When Wisconsin's seal was first created, back during the earliest days of statehood, the sailor was one of the most valuable members of the workforce.
There were very few roads back then, so it was on the liquid highway of the Great Lakes that people came flooding in and raw materials went pouring out of Wisconsin.
And the workhorse on that liquid highway was the Great Lakes schooner. We hadn't built a schooner in Wisconsin for over 100 years.
But here in Milwaukee, the Wisconsin Lake Schooner Education Association is building the Dennis Sullivan to remind us of our rich maritime heritage.
Come gather round, boys, now all hands.
Heave her up, lads, heave her high.
Lean and heave her, all who can.
Heave her up and bust her.
Oh, we'll say farewell to this old town.
Heave her up, lads, heave her high.
We'll ship once more, we're outward bound.
Heave her up and bust her.
There's not a lot been written about the Great Lakes schooners, and there are things that make them different. Half the blueprints are in the office, and half the blueprints are, I guess, in my head. At this stage in the boat, we're trying to figure out what a Great Lakes schooner looks like compared to a non-Great Lakes schooner.
Or any damn load that can be found.
Heave her up and bust her.
Last night the moon had a golden ring.
Heave her up, let's heave her high.
And that foul weather is sure to bring.
Heave her up and bust her.
Oh, the wind's...
The lake schooners were the backbone of trade in the 19th century. Extremely important to the development of the region, and that's why we chose to build this vessel, so that we could use it as a platform for learning. Learning about the lakes, preserving in a very hands-on way our state's maritime heritage. There was a period of about 50 years when Milwaukee itself was a very active shipbuilding port. There were at least a dozen yards stretched along the lakefront and up the Milwaukee River, building, repairing vessels of various sizes. On a given day, you can imagine coming down here, and there might have been a couple of dozen of these tall ships with their masts towering up into the sky.
Heave her up, lads, heave her high.
We'll bury deeper leeward rail.
Heave her up and
hold,
buster.
Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin has been one of the most active boat-building and shipbuilding cities on the Great Lakes. The majority of families in this town have worked in the ship or boat yards, sailed on its vessels, or fished from its tugs. A powerful force, the shipbuilding industry has been around for 150 years. It began when Robert and Alexander Lowry started building boats here in 1855. Robert and Alexander created schooners and with native wood gave them strength and vitality. These vessels were used for fishing, trading, transportation, recreation, anything the Great Lakes needed at the time. In the early 1900s, most ships generally went from wood to steel. Nails became rivets, which became welds, and sails gave way to steam, which gave way to diesel. When World War II began, the nature and the purpose of the ships changed. On September 3, 1939, when the Allies declared war on Germany, Peterson Boatworks embarked on their first Navy job, personnel boats. This was followed by other Navy contracts. The tempo of the shipyards changed, and the city's four shipbuilders needed workers.
I went for an interview on a Sunday afternoon with Commander Anderson, and he said, "Hello, you're hired."
People came to the shipyards from all over the Midwest. In a short time, employment went from 600 to no less than 7,000 men and women. It was the first time women entered the Sturgeon Bay shipyards as welders. Dorothy Moskaller was one of the first.
My future husband started out welding, and I thought, well, if he can do it and other women can do it, so can I.
You got so many assignments when you went to work, they'd give you a where you're going to work for the day. See, then you had to run to the welding shop, and you had to get to what kind of welding rod you needed for the type of work you had. If you had flat welding, you had different rods, see? So then when you get through with your job, all you do is go back to the foreman again. He gives you some more.
It was awfully noisy in town with the shipyards. You could hear it all over town with the chippers and burners, and they were pounding on this metal trying to make it fit, you know. But we all got used to it.
After all of the work on a ship was done, an official launching was arranged, usually on a Saturday. It was a special event during a time when rationing and cutting back were an everyday occurrence. Betty Krieger, who worked in the Navy office, was chosen to sponsor a ship. She was 17.
I was a girl from a small town doing a big job. To be able to sponsor a ship, that was an honor, you know.
So you got all dressed up?
Got all dressed up. I got dressed up. It took me 3 hours in the morning to get dressed up. I couldn't figure out what I was going to wear. And I was standing up there on that scaffolding, looked down at their faces, and they were just in awe. They were just, they were so proud. You could see it in their faces. You shut your eyes, and you hit it, and you break it. And sometimes you have to take a second hit like I did. Then the ship slides down and goes in sideways.
Launching after launching, the four Sturgeon Bay shipbuilding companies cranked out ships. During the height of the war, ships were launched every 5 days.
We were always fond of seeing those boats go in the water, knowing that we had a part of it.
In total, 258 wartime ships were set upon the water at Sturgeon Bay. And for its efforts, it received the Navy Award for Excellence. Wartime gave Sturgeon Bay a big boost. Throughout the next few decades, this little city in Door County continued the tradition of these shipbuilders. And the strength of the shipbuilding companies remains with its people, craftsmen, engineers, designers, and of course, welders.
Technology has come such a long ways. So I wish they could see our technology and where we're at, and I would have loved to have seen their working conditions.
Today, the companies in operation are luxury yacht builder Palmer Johnson and Bay Shipbuilding, which builds and repairs a variety of vessels. Of its 350 employees, 7 or 8 are women who weld.
I love my job. I love welding. I love getting out and doing the work.
Launchings now occur approximately once every 2 years in Sturgeon Bay. But whether the vessels are meant for recreation or transportation, the workers still take pride in what they do.
When you start a ship, you have no idea what it's going to look like, and when it comes to life, when it's finally the body and everything's together, yeah, it's really neat to see it done.
Our hands are sore and our backs are humped.
Leave her, laddies, leave her.
And half the lakes went through her pump.
And it's time for us to leave her.
Oh,
leave her, laddies, leave her. Oh, leave her, laddies, leave her. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow. And it's time for us to leave her.
Today we sometimes think of water as an obstruction standing in our way. But in the time before railroads and paved highways, it was water that offered the clear and easy path to any destination. But travelers on that path never forgot that mortal danger was forever only a moment away.
the keeper's log of the light station was where they were supposed to record things such as the wind, the waves, the temperature conditions, and any unusual events that occurred in the operation of the light station. November 19, 1886. From tower, saw a vessel with two masts pretty close to the shore. I went down, I found it was a bar, correct. It appeared they'd let go their anchors. I discovered three bodies, one in the main and one in the mizzing rigging. Think of a captain who has got a cargo to deliver on a crummy night and think what's going through the captain's mind. This will probably be the last trip of the season. Should we go out? Should we hold off? Time is money in those days. And what you've got is the Lucerne loading a cargo of iron ore in Ashland. Brand new ore docks, railroad lines being built, bring in iron and loading it here for transportation to the mills in Cleveland and Pittsburgh.
And Cleveland is which way?
Cleveland from here, that way, and a long way off. They were heading up the shore of the Upper Peninsula in Michigan when the storm really turned nasty, and Captain Lloyd made a decision which I'm sure went against his grain to a large degree, but he said, we're going to have to turn around and head back to Ashland for the safety of the Apostle Islands, where he could ride out the storm perhaps in the lee of an island. And then the thing is, he almost made it.
The Lucerne went down about a quarter mile from Long Island, where we see that buoy. The buoy comes up right from the Lucerne's bow.
Now, you're a diver, and you've been down there.
Yep, right down here is the Lucerne.
And what have you seen? What can you tell from what you've seen?
It's very interesting if we combine the historical record with the archaeological record to really give a complete picture of what happened that night. We believe Captain Lloyd probably wasn't too sure where he was, decided he had to stop for fear of running into one of the islands. The windlass and capstan are the device used to raise and lower the anchor. And in the windlass chain, there's a 4.5-foot crowbar jammed into the chain. The centerboard, which is a device used to stabilize a schooner like the Lucerne, is actually pivoted on the forward end, and it comes down into the water like this. And it's not designed to hit the bottom, going backwards. So probably what happened, the anchor started to drag. Something went wrong with the anchor gear. It's being pushed back, centerboard hit the bottom, twisted, and the centerboard probably acted like a big lever and just started tearing the vessel apart as these guys were on it. They tried to escape death from drowning and climb the rigging and hoping again to ride out the storm. But when they were cut down, they were covered in 1 to 6 inches of ice. We came out and placed the buoy on the wreck to give divers access to it and to help protect the wreck from anchor damage from dive boats. Without the buoy, the dive boats would come to the area and drag their anchors until they actually hook into the wreck. One of the major resources we work with is shipwrecks, and the Lucerne is one of 700 in the state.
But 700?
Yes, 700 shipwrecks in the state. And they're in Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, the Mississippi River, some of our inland lakes even have shipwrecks in them. To visit a shipwreck in general is to actually take a trip back in time. It's one of the few remaining parts of our maritime heritage that are left. As archaeologists, we like to say that we use those vessels that didn't make it to tell the stories of those that did.
The story of those that did continues into the present day, told in places like the twin ports of Duluth and Superior, where the Liquid Highway remains well-traveled.
How busy are these twin ports?
Average number of vessel passages is 1,000 per year. About 200 of them are ocean vessels like this one. Interestingly, at the turn of the century, in the late 1890s, there were as many as 7,000 a year.
So from 7,000 to 1,000?
To 1,000.
But these are big.
Yeah, they carry more cargo today with 1,000 vessels than they did with 7,000. It's one of the finest natural harbors on the whole of the Great Lakes, and the tonnage here is still very high. It's 14th in the nation. At one time, it was second only to New York, enormous tonnage.
What makes this a good harbor?
Well, basically the proximity to the natural resources. The Iron Range is very near here. It's only 60 miles by rail. Railroads also have easy access to the grain fields in the Red River Valley. So it's very near the commodities and a very efficient way to get these products onto shipboard for movement down the lakes.
Well, how would this differ from some of the earlier grain carriers? Because grain's been carried a long time on Lake Superior.
The earliest were sailing vessels, schooners, usually 3 or 4 masted, 150 to 200 feet, carried about 1,000 tons.
Wooden boats?
wooden vessels, that's right, until the 1880s. There was quite a transition between 1880 and about 1900 when all the sailing vessels literally disappeared and the whole trade went into much more efficient steamers of much larger dimension as well. And around the turn of the century, the last wooden steamers disappeared and much larger steel vessels began to take their place, 400 and 500 footers. Since then, the size and capacity have increased to 1,000 feet in the case of the largest vessels.
Now, for the earliest grain vessels, how many do you think would fit into this ship?
This vessel carries 1 million bushels or 30,000 tons. The earliest grain carriers here carried about 1,000 tons, so 30 vessels. And interestingly, each of those 30 vessels had a crew equivalent to this one, about 28 or 30 men. So the efficiency has increased enormously over this century or so.
It's a lot of grain, and it's on its way to Algeria. And so here in Superior, mm-hmm. it's in what's an international port. Would you call this an international port?
Oh, absolutely. Exactly. These are navigation charts for the whole Great Lakes system.
Show us where we are and how this ship is going to.
Okay, well,
leave
this
the
is
lakes.
The western extremity of the whole system. When the ship leaves here, it'll go almost 400 miles on the open lake before it reaches the St. Mary's River at Sault Ste. Marie. After passing through the locks there, it'll go from Lake Superior's level to the level of Lake Huron. Then it will pass from Lake Huron through the St. Clair River, Lake St. Clair, Detroit River, into Lake Erie. At the eastern end of Lake Erie, it will pass through the locks of the Welland Ship Canal that basically bypass Niagara Falls to the Lake Ontario level. Then, passing from Lake Ontario, they'll go through the St. Lawrence Seaway system that'll take it down to sea level. But it's 2,400 miles, about 5 days, and 602 feet elevation difference from beginning to end. Yeah, it's a really fascinating engineering feat when you stop to think of it.
A fascinating engineering feat indeed, and one so important to the vitality of the United States that during World War II, the locks at Sault Ste. Marie were more heavily protected by the U.S. military than the Panama Canal.
So I would have left from Georgian Bay, going across the Straits of Mackinac.
And you came down the lake.
Where it caught fire and 60 people died.
Well, it caught fire up on Manitowoc in that area.
With that boy, I don't get why they took it
off. How you doing?
Good. How are you
been? I'm doing all right.
This is a waterproof slate that has been developed where divers can take it down to the site with them, and it kind of gives them a guided tour of the site. This is the archaeological drawing, scaled way down to fit on the card. On the back side, it has a history, a little bit about the background of the vessel, but then also how it sank, and then along with location information. So. Divers know where to find it. It helps them get into the area to the buoy, which we're going to be placing out there today.
You mean you're not a diver? Oh, man, we can take care of that for you. You don't know what you're missing around here.
No, it looks great.
Our diving is probably some of the best in the Great Lakes.
Why is that?
It's just our shipwrecks are the best. We chartered people from all over. We had a group from England come over here 2 weeks ago. We took them out here, and the people live right around here. They don't dive our wrecks. They have no idea what they're missing.
What's the earliest wreck that you've dove to?
Probably this one here, 1856.
Tell me the story. We know where the wreck is right here.
The wreck is right
where
here.
Where did it start on fire?
She started on fire out here probably, I don't know, I said 15 minutes before she sunk. She was probably another 1,000 feet out or so when she started on fire, started burning. And he was heading for shore. And what happened is they started throwing stuff off as they came in, and the wreck started to fall apart. And if you go out there this way and start following in, you'll see the parts all the way in. He drifted up to here. People evidently either where it fell off here because she was burning the water line by here.
So they can see the shore from here.
It's right there, 3/4 mile away.
And 60 people are thought to have died.
At least 65, yeah, died. It's got to be a bad way to go. They had a lot of heavy wools on them when they jumped in the water. There was no way they could swim. They just sunk. Went down with everything they had.
Close enough for hope and
yeah.
Far enough for disaster.
How was it down there, Jeff?
Good.
Nice dive.
Well, this is the Lady Elgin. It's really typical of that whole class of ships I refer to as palace steamers. And they were principally immigrant ships. The Niagara was a great deal like the Lady Elgin.
So did you build this yourself?
As a matter of fact, yes, I am building it. It's still incomplete. There isn't a whole lot of technological data around about these ships, so I'm learning from observation of various shipwrecks, as a matter of fact. It's a fun project.
So the shipwrecks are informing how you build this?
Exactly.
Why were they called palace steamers?
Well, they were particularly lavish vessels. So they had Brussels carpeting in the upper decks, mm-hmm. and they had fountains with sprinkling water. But on the other hand, they also had to serve the steerage passengers who had no money to enjoy all the niceties. The passenger cabins are aligned on the upper deck here, mm-hmm. and usually could accommodate maybe 200 passengers or so. But the steerage passengers were carried below decks in what is essentially the freight space in very plain surroundings. Frankly, it was pretty darn unpleasant. It was very crowded. It was usually very warm. You know, you get the idea of passenger travel much as it is today, and that's a real fallacy. It smelled different, it sounded different, and it was different.
If somebody was on a steamer, would they be seeing other boats?
In the old days, yes. As a matter of fact, there was an awful lot of congestion. There were more than 2,000 ships on the lakes in 1870. Today we have about 150.
So these really were highways.
Oh yeah, yes, they certainly were.
When we talk about a flood of immigrants, we sometimes forget that the flood was composed of individuals, men and women and children, who are remembered today as pioneering ancestors.
I talked to my mom. She gave me a pretty good family tree to start with. Grandparents on her mother's side, the day they left Norway, the name of the ship they were on, when they arrived in La Crosse, and I just started with that information.
Where do you go next?
Well, I took the information and started playing on the internet. I went to a search engine, I put in Norwegian genealogy, and up popped a bunch of websites, including the digital archives in Norway.
Really?
And they have passenger lists. It was really bizarre because I started getting tingly about 3 pages before they came up. And I was alone in the office that day, and I shrieked.
But you look at what happens. Smallpox, typhus fever, 2 infants die of convulsions, mm-hmm. Pneumonia. It must be a very dangerous crossing.
It was. I have read through some of these travel narratives, and I would not be this brave.
No,
this incredible. To me would be like saying, yes, I'll be on that first ship to the moon, not knowing if you were going to get there, but pretty well knowing you'd never see anybody you knew again back home.
In terms of transportation from Quebec to Wisconsin, how easy is it to determine what route they took and what type of transportation they used?
I haven't actually started looking for that part yet. I haven't known where to look. So that's one of the reasons I'm here.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Bev Johnson.
Yes.
I'd like to do some genealogy, and I'm wondering if you can lend me.
Okay, we'll try.
My mom's genealogy is what I'm working on. It's all from Norway. And they came to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. How did they get from Quebec to La Crosse?
Getting from a point in the eastern part of North America to the Midwest, at what time period?
We're talking the late 1860s.
Late 1860s. You're at the period when there were multiple choices by water and by railroad, and it's likely that they used both mm-hmm. methods for at least part of the trip. The primary method from Quebec to Western Lake Michigan was by water. There was regular lake steamer service.
I think I'd like to look at those passenger arrivals for Quebec.
Okay, that's a good possibility. Let's take a look in the catalog and see if we can come up with them.
Okay, great. Well, I think I've got enough to get going on.
Enough to keep you going for the better part of a day, I suspect.
I think so. Thank you very much.
Okay, good luck. The internet has had a major impact on how people do genealogical research. What happens in many cases is that people start and end with the internet. And there is so much additional material that is not available online yet, and there's always more that can be investigated. And you can't do that by hitting some keys and waiting for the electronic magic to happen. We're one of the larger historical and genealogical libraries in the entire country. Simply getting thousands of people a year to the right one of the 3.5 million items we have in our collection is a sufficient challenge to keep us occupied.
There we go. That is just
like it.
Oh, labor, laddies, labor, for the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to labor.
And just before that ship did go,
labor, laddies, labor,
the rats, they marched off in a row,
and it's time for us to labor.
Oh,
labor, laddies, labor, oh, labor, laddies, labor. For the voyage is done and the winds don't blow, and it's time for us to labor.
It's exciting to envision and think about kids out with us for a four-hour voyage of discovery and learning, to see this finally becoming a reality. What started as a dream shared by a small handful of people and has now been embraced by literally thousands of people in this area. And to know that soon it will begin its journeys and adventures on the Great Lakes and elsewhere.
Now the mate was a shell back from below.
Leave her, laddies, leave her.
To curse and roar he well did know.
And it's time for us to leave her.
Oh,
leave her, laddies, leave her. Oh, leave her, laddies, leave her.
Well, that's it for this week's Wisconsin Stories.
If they find us here, we'll see you next week.
If not, bon voyage.
From Wisconsin Stories.
To learn more about our maritime history and other Wisconsin stories, visit our website at wisconsinstories.org. Major funding for Wisconsin Stories is provided by the Mead Witter Foundation, Incorporated, Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Additional funding is provided by the Halbert and Alice Kadish Foundation, Philip J. and Elizabeth B. Hendrickson, and an advised fund of the Community Foundation of Southern Wisconsin.